Second hour of Budweiser's weekday sports beat on Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT. Mike Singer from Blue and Gold will talk a little Notre Dame football recruiting with us at 5:30. But, of course, we've got Notre Dame baseball in super regional action starting tomorrow down in Starkville, Mississippi. Did I say Starkville, Mississippi? I did say Starkville, Mississippi. And someone who was there in 2000 when Notre Dame was there for a regional was Pete LaFleur, former Notre Dame baseball sports information director. He was the SID for that, I guess maybe you'd say historic or at least memorable trip to Starkville back in 2000. And Pete and I worked together for 7 years when I was doing Notre Dame baseball play-by-play, and he was the SID. Always a pleasure, unless it was after a baseball game in San Antonio at like 10 o'clock at night, and I wanted to go get something to eat, and Pete was like, oh, just let me finish up this story.
and we were roommates often.
That's right.
You know, we had a great time and had some great meals, and we definitely sampled a lot of the best margaritas in the San Antonio area.
That's right. Margaritas, barbecue, Mexican food, whatever it would happen to be. A little bit of everything.
We did our own little Yelp review or whatever you might call it.
That's right. Well, let's jump into this, Pete, because there's so much to get to with this subject. Again, you were there at that Starkville Regional, and it has kind of become, you know, just like this legend. And I listened to a couple podcast interviews with Steve Stanley and Paul O'Toole, who were on that team for Notre Dame, and it was guys down in Starkville who interviewed them. Yep. And you know, we've spent a lot of time this week talking about just the atmosphere at Duty Noble Field that Notre Dame's going to be experiencing this weekend, and just what an impression that weekend left on Notre Dame. But it struck me, Pete, listening to those interviews, just how much of an impression Notre Dame also left on those Mississippi State people. What do you think?
Oh, no question. And as you know, Sean, we both have covered the College World Series over the past few years at different times. And,
right,
you know, when we would bump into Mississippi State fans there, including a guy, I believe his name's Jim Ellis, he's the radio guy. But and I heard that Everett, the bus driver, is still there. We were picked up by the Mississippi State bus driver, who's a legend named Everett. He picked us up at the airport. And the team bus had satellite TV on it. This is back in 2000.
In 2000,
and it was decked out. But he told Jeremy Gray, shared, who was the radio guy before you, Jeremy. He shared that
I know Jeremy.
With Jeremy that that was the greatest game that's been ever been played at Duty Noble.
That's amazing.
And I also bumped into a Mississippi State fan. I believe his last name's Mahoney or Maloney, and he runs a big tailgater at Omaha every year, regardless of whether Mississippi State's not there or not. And he told me the same thing. And I've heard that countless times from people. And I think they just really embraced the spirit of the Notre Dame team. And they could tell, you know, what a unified group they were. And they really respected. Because I think, and we experienced this in 2002, we went to Florida State for the Super Regional. I think a lot of schools from the warmer climates and just kind of assume that this team from
Northern
the north
team.
They're
yeah cute little
their
story.
Their staff their results are inflated, and oh, they're playing UConn and Valparaiso, you know, whatever, like, and but they, it's just like what you know, you and I saw in Tallahassee in 02. They just gradually won people over, and they, you know, they were still cheering for the team, but they definitely respected them.
The atmosphere at Duty Noble down there, would you just liken it to football game in a baseball park? Is that kind of the best way to describe it?
Well, so I don't know what it, I think it's fairly similar now, but people, you know, bring their pickup trucks and their RVs and whatnot up against the outfield fence.
Right.
And there's all these ramshackle contraptions of, and it looks, you know, to be honest, incredibly dangerous, but there's all these just like chairs and everything. And then there's just, smoke and amazing barbecue smells, intoxicating, frankly. And so, yeah, it does take you, it does give you the atmosphere of like a really good college football tailgater. And, you know, one cool thing is like, you know, we're not used to it at Notre Dame, but it's like, you know, a lot of these games are like 100 degrees or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, everyone's running around in shorts and t-shirts and, you know, tank tops or whatever. And it's just like a so it's kind of like a big picnic or a festival, or like, you know, it's like the Woodstock of college basketball.
Yeah.
Or college baseball, rather.
Now, so you said that was one of the best games ever played when you were referring to it. Now, of course, there was a series of games played down
right.
there that weekend, and it ended up being Notre Dame and Mississippi State in the final game, the championship. Notre Dame forced a final game that was won on a walk-off home run by the Bulldogs. But a lot of baseball played before that, and part of the craziness of that weekend, Pete, a tornado that went through there that led to Notre Dame playing what? Parts of four games in like a 24-hour span or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. And I realize some of your listeners kind of know how college baseball works with the regional format. But back in the day, as I'm sure you know, you would play the first two games on Friday, but there would actually be three games on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have the elimination game, the winner's bracket game, and then the second elimination game would be on Saturday night. Now that second elimination game is on Sunday, and then they go into the regional final later on Sunday. And if there's a quote-unquote necessary game, that pushes to Monday. But back then, they tried to tie the whole thing up in 3 days, seven games with three on that middle day. So you were walking a fine line with the schedule. And, and I guess Mississippi State is known for some crazy weather. And a tornado touchdown within a mile of the stadium. We had a delay of almost 2.5 hours. We had to go into the basketball arena, which Jeff Felker's dad was saying this is probably the least safe place we could have been, but that's where they put us. And and we went back out, and a guy, John Corbin, who was our closer, you know, ultimately ended up going five innings, almost 100 pitches, and we rallied from a 5-0 or 6-1 deficit. I think it was 6-1. We came back and won 10-6, and Corbs like really helped save the bullpen for what we had to take on later in the weekend. So then we had to come back on Sunday and play Mississippi State twice. Dead tired. We stayed in a hotel in a town called Columbus, which is 30 minutes away. So that's an hour round trip, just getting back to the hotel and then coming back. Yeah. And you'll love this, Sean. Like after the final game, you know, I was working on my story because, as you know, I'm always taking photos
were.
And I was helping Jeremy.
Did you have the full size computer you were taking at that point on the road with the full size, you know, monitor in the box
the
and all that?
The big monitor, probably.
Four laptops.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, so like I remember like finishing my game story at something crazy like 4 a.m. or something, you know, but the bus pulled out of the hotel at like 6 a.m. or something. So
oh
I literally, I know I didn't, I mean, this won't shock you, but I definitely didn't sleep that night. And but we had just played all this crazy stuff. And I actually did an interview with those same guys that interviewed O'Toole and Stanley this morning. So that was kind of cool. So I don't know if you got my my sponsorship lead-in intro thing. You didn't play it, but I'm now represented. It's supposed to say Pete LaFleur joins you courtesy of Yuengling Lager.
Oh,
so
nice,
I
fine
so
East
I've got
Coast
a,
Lager.
I've got a sponsorship.
Potsdam,
yes,
Pennsylvania.
Yes, I know how you love your Yuengling.
Yeah, well, and so do you. So, I mean, there's no arguing any of that. And they finally, you know, we've had it here in Indiana for the last few years.
Yes, exactly.
He's Pete LaFleur, former Notre Dame baseball sports information director, was with Notre Dame back in the 2000 season when they went to that Starkville, Mississippi regional. He now writes for collegebaseball360.com, the editor there covering college baseball at large. And now those interviews you were talking about, the O'Toole and Stanley, some great stuff that I heard in there. And so there's a play at the plate, and Paul O'Toole, the catcher, Steve Stanley compared him to a hockey enforcer, basically.
Right.
Paul wasn't afraid of mixing it up, and I love that fire in Paul. I mean, there was a lot of fire on that team, whether it was, you know, O'Toole, Stanley, Bushy, you know, go on and on and on. But so Paul O'Toole kind of becomes the villain of the weekend. Fill in the gaps on that story.
Paul clarified he wanted to point out that the throw was up the third base line
right.
that he was getting. I think the runner's name was Willingham, and I think he was trying to score from first, so he had a full head of steam. And so, you know, if you can picture it, Paul grabbed the ball, and then Paul's kind of trying to get back towards home plate. And I think he kind of swung the glove and kind of hit the guy in the shoulder, if I remember correctly, or something like that. But it wasn't your typical just, like, swipe and a tag to try to get a guy on the leg as he's sliding home. But I guess it evolved into people claiming that he was blocking the plate and all this crazy stuff. But the bench is emptied and you know, Paul credits the umps with really diffusing the whole thing.
Yeah.
But you know how fans can get. You know, they just I don't, every time Paul came up, they booed and everything like that.
For the rest of the
what's that? The whole rest of the weekend, and that was they had the big outfield bleachers, and they had the thing where they throw the ball back. But on that final day, he he's a left-handed hitter, and he parked one to right field, and it went over the bleachers. And I think I joked in the recap that it was too far for them to throw it back, or whatever. So that was kind of funny. But I was joking with you that and I'm saying this totally jokingly because Paul and Steve are both amazing guys, but it's funny that they interviewed Steve Stanley and Paul too, because Steve was very very religious and was very he was very clear that he was a very religious person, but he was a little more clean cut. I mean, he's hard nosed, but so Steve and Paul to me are kind of like the little angel and the little devil on Paul Mineri's shoulder.
But
that's what was great about that team. And
you
got to
have both if you want to win, right?
Yeah, that team had balance, and it had quite a collection of personalities. I mean, if you think of the other guys in that class, and I'm sorry if I forget anyone, but people like Drew Duff, like what a character.
Yeah.
And so many times
Bushy,
in his career, he wasn't
Bach,
like
Ken Meyer.
Yeah, but someone like Drew, he didn't have the physical tools of an Aaron Heilman or a Jeff Samardzija on the mound, but Drew Duff got some pretty awesome outings for us, and including I think he had five solid innings in Starkville to help us get through that regional. So, but Strick Roth, Kenny Meyer, the Mongoose.
That's right.
Obviously Bushy, Strick Roth, Matt Buckmeyer, another pitcher from Indiana. So, but that's kind of the rundown on that.
Now that weekend ends with Mississippi State winning on a walk-off home run, and Steve Stanley, of course, the center fielder. He thinks he's got a play on that ball, and he runs into the wall. The ball goes out of the park. Two fans hop the fence and end up walking him, back to the Notre Dame dugout. That sounded and as it turned out, one of the guys who was interviewing him in that podcast was one of those two fans. So that was kind of a little cool connection too.
His name's Charlie, and he actually has a law degree from Notre Dame, but he's a Mississippi State undergrad, and so. Brian, I remember distinctly Brian Stavisky was running over from right field to console Steve, but he couldn't even get there before the Mississippi State fans picked him up. And I don't know if you saw it on the thread I have on the Twitter feed, Sean, but I have a video clip of the final 4 minutes of that game or whatever.
I did see the home run, yeah.
Yeah, but it also shows, I think, parts of the eighth inning. Yeah, but and a lot of people ask me, like, what do you remember? And I, again, this won't surprise you, but I was just so busy doing my job and trying to help Jeremy and stuff like that. Like, I wish I could have gone out and just, like, walked around the left field lounge. And
you remember
really
the smells of the barbecue.
yeah, I remember that. And I just, when I, in my role as an SID, and I want to capture the memories and preserve the history. And I don't want to go home feeling like, God, I wish I would have, been more focused on doing my job. And I felt like going, being a fan was not why I was there, to go around and soak all that up. So I don't have a lot of great personal stories.
I wanted to ask you a little, as we swing it forward a little bit to this year's team, Nico Cavadas, of course, with the power, the 21 home runs that he has this year. And he's just a few home runs behind Brant Ust on the career list. Now, I think Ust, did he graduate in 99? Does that sound right?
So Ust,
before that team?
Yeah, Ust was, Ust, a great player, obviously. He got drafted by the Tigers and only played three seasons.
Yeah.
So
compare the power.
Jeff Wagner,
compare the power of those guys.
Jeff Wagner was a four-year guy. Jeff Wagner was more the traditional kind of power guy.
Okay.
Ust was just a great all-around hitter. I've only seen Nico, on a bits and pieces. I think you've probably seen him more than me. I think Nico's more pure power. It sounds like you guys had a great interview with Nico earlier in the week, and I did listen to that. So thanks for archiving that and whatnot. And
sure.
It sounds like they've really done some great work with all the hitters in like instituting their system. And you would know the nomenclature and whatnot more than I do, but it sounds like they've really helped get him locked in. And I think Darren was talking to him about how he's quiet, quote unquote, quieter at the plate. He's not
right.
He doesn't have the timing mechanism in the late kick and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, Branas, he had like a three home run game and whatnot. Now, you know, I give Nico credit because he's doing this against, like, you know, in a lot of cases against ACC pitching, and we weren't. You know, we were doing it against Big East pitching. So I can't really compare the two because I just haven't seen enough of Nico.
Sure.
I do think it's amazing that he told Todd Walker that he doesn't even bench. and I think Chuck Freebie on your interview with Chuck, and Chuck gave some great insight as well. But Chuck said, like, his biceps have biceps, or his biceps have a Twitter handle.
I was
going to
say,
that,
if so. You saw him when they were wearing those, like the vest with the undershirts on Sunday in the regional
yeah.
championship game, they highlighted Nico's guns for sure.
I love Chuck's observation, and this is switching gears to defense, but I think for my keen statistical eye, just looking at the team stats, and I mean, the fact, I think they have like 26 errors in 44 games,
mm-hmm.
which is like a, whatever you want to look at it, like a minus 18, which is tremendous. Anytime you're even somewhere around 1-1 is a really good ratio. But they moved Jared Miller to second base, correct? And they put, is it Prisner? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, at shortstop.
They put Prisner, yeah, they moved him. They flipped the middle infielders, basically, and to maximize their strengths better. And, you know, that's no knock against the previous coaching staff or whatever, but Coach Jarrett came in, and with his other coaches, they decided to do that. And it looks like it's shown great benefits. And I guess
uh-oh. I think we just – oh, there he is.
Hannigan at third, who by all – what's that?
I think we lost you there for a second. Yeah, we dropped you for a second. Can you still hear me?
Oh, that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I would just say those defensive changes have really, I don't know where it cut out. So
I don't either.
But the flipping the middle infielders and focusing Nico at first, and I know they're happy with Jack Brannigan at third, and I know Brannigan can even close in a pinch if they need it. He's got a really strong arm. So
yeah.
It just sounds like Coach Jarrett really came in and kind of evaluated things and made the changes. And it sounds like the players were really open to doing whatever, you know, doing what was advised them to do to make it a winning program again. And it was very impressive how he went out of his way to visit the players when they were with their summer league
yeah,
teams
absolutely.
And stuff like that. I heard that in the interview, and I was really impressed with that because that's a personal touch, you know.
Yep.
So
absolutely.
I did notice in looking at Coach Jarrett's bio, by the way, that, and I don't know if you picked up on this, but, you know, he did have a stint at Auburn and was actually like the SEC Assistant Coach of the Year, you know, that
right.
site that Mark Etheridge used to run. But, and they went to Mississippi State, they went to Mississippi State twice, and one time they won the series. And so he has some familiarity, and then I think someone referenced it that the, is it Scott Wingo? Or you, I think you asked
yeah.
Nico
from South Carolina.
Coach Wingo, who you and I, of course, remember when he was at South Carolina. So I think little things like that can help, you know. And I just said that everyone in the program is not totally new to this environment, you
yeah,
know.
Absolutely.
So.
Pete, I wanted to ask you before we wrap up. Of course, you worked with Paul Maneri for the bulk of his career. I think all but one of his years. At Notre Dame, and he's going to be retiring. Just, you know, kind of some thoughts on that, and you, what you think his legacy is ultimately.
Well, I was thinking, like, you know, when I came to Notre Dame, I had actually been at Virginia, and we played in the same regional, ironically, as Notre Dame did at the University of Alabama. But then I come to Notre Dame, and Paul immediately just took me under his wing and made me a part of the program. And you know this too from traveling, you know, he treats the support staff on a certain level where in the team does as well. And
yep.
you would think that happens with every coach in every sport, and it doesn't when you're in that type of role. Not that other coaches don't appreciate you, but Coach Maneri really added that genuine personal touch. He took me to the varsity shop and got me like three top of the line Cutter and Buck polo shirts, you know, the first day I was there. And, you know, the SID office wasn't doing anything like that. I certainly wasn't going to fork out $60 a shirt or whatever for myself. And, you know, I mean, sports information is not, we're not in it for the money, that profession. But that was just his way of saying, like, I want you to look good at the, you know, at the games. And he was always like that. He'd have us over for New Year's Eve, and his buddy Jim Henry would be there, and who's great, you know, an amazingly guy. And, very different from Paul, but I can see why they're friends. And but I mean, you saw the program Paul created and the type of players he recruited. And, you know, I think of, like, Aaron Heilman. Like, Paul went out of his way not to abuse Aaron Heilman's arm. Right. You know, he would not do what so many other college coaches have done over the year and bring him back later in a regional. That just did not happen. And, you know, people would be asking, do you think you're going to bring Heilman back on Sunday? And Paul's like, no, this guy's got a major league career, you know, waiting ahead for him. And, you know, when Paul went to LSU, I went as his friend, I was concerned. I think you probably not concerned, but we knew what he was walking into,
mm-hmm.
you know, a very demanding.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw one article that said, like, yeah, you got 10,000 fans, and, you know, it's great, but you also have 10,000 second guessers, you know, who are going to, you know, and, you know, he was, I think it's important to remember, he was the succeeding Smoke Laval, who was not a terribly successful coach. He wasn't succeeding Skip Bertman, but he was always in Skip's shadow. And I thought it was cool, you know, Paul said in his press conference that he hoped Skip was proud of him. And I guess Skip stepped up and said at the press conference that he was proud of Paul. And but Paul was, you know, he wore his emotions on the sleeve. I mean, he was very gentlemanly and polite, but we know, like, he was a fierce competitor, and
absolutely.
He would definitely hold the team to, you know, high standards. I think he went to that LSU program and he demanded academic integrity. He wanted his players to be role models within the community, and I think people at LSU appreciated that. And I step back from it, and I think it's so awesome that he was able to take the format that he had at Notre Dame and apply it to a place like LSU and make it work and prove that, you know, you don't have to be totally cutthroat and you don't have to cut corners to be successful. Now, there's plenty of people, you know, he's a Hall of Fame coach. I don't think there's a Hall of Fame coach that's been criticized and scrutinized as much as he has. And it's sad that he's had his neck issues, and he I've heard him say he just didn't feel the same way. And, hopefully this will kind of invigorate him. I heard he's going to try to go and visit a lot of his former players and stuff, and hopefully you and I get to see him at some point here in the future. But, you know, he was a very close friend, and, you know, I remember getting to tell him when we got voted number one, and I guess he still tells that story, and so I'm part of, like, the stories that he tells when he goes out on a speaking engagement.
Of course
you are. So I just have to tell a funny story for your listeners real quick.
All right.
You know, he walked in the room and it was really cold, and you and I were rooming together, and we had most people would just say, wow, it's cold in here. Like, or they say, Burr, and he, you could hang a ham in here. That was just Paul. He was just very, very unique. And this is, like, you know, the visual, but it's like hanging a ham hock from the top of the ceiling or something. You know?
That was our go-to line for many years after that. whenever we turned on the AC, you can hang
but if
a
you
ham
think about
in
it,
here,
like,
guys.
Yeah, but you know, if Paul's parents moved to South Bend, God bless them. They moved to South Bend at their
Florida.
Age. To be around Paul and to be around their grandkids, and then, you know, I think they followed him to Baton Rouge as well. And I could still remember also being at Paul's house some nights, and he would go and, you know, and say goodnight to his son, Tommy. When Tommy was, he was still a kid, but he wasn't like a little kid, but Paul just loved his son so much. And it was important for him to see his kid before he went to bed. And, and I think Paul loved his players that way too. And I know a lot of the LSU players,
the whole thing's a family. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And 1500 wins along the way, and he worked at some pretty legitimate, you know, Air Force Academy is a very prestigious school, and obviously Notre Dame is as well. And I don't think he has anything to be ashamed of. I think he wished he could have won more and everything, but he did win a national championship at LSU. And, you know, I just, hopefully that kind of answers your question.
A lot of 40-win seasons in the SEC. That's, I mean, he did a lot of winning down there as well. A lot of 40-win seasons, obviously, here at Notre Dame as well. Great stuff, Pete.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. It's always great to catch up. We need to pop some of those brewskis.
All right.
We might have to make it a cold Budweiser. But, yeah, you too. I will talk to you soon.
Sean and I call each other Hit Dog because we went to Mo Vaughn's Hit Dog batting cage one time.
Right.
So that's our little pet name for each other, Hit Dog. Very random, which is my style.
That's right. I'll see you, Hit Dog.
Okay. Okay, give my best to the family.
I will. Take care.
All right.
Pete LaFleur, former Notre Dame baseball sports information director, currently of collegebaseball360.com. You can follow him on Twitter at CB, as in boy, 360 updates. He's got to be a little more brief on Twitter because you only get so many characters there. So love him all the same. All right. We're going to take a timeout. Mike Singer will join us next. Hopefully we'll do that. Budweiser's weekday sports beat brought to you by Budweiser, locally distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend. Sports fans, this Bud's for you. Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger's a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. And Tim Grau State Farm Insurance. You need life insurance today. Tomorrow will be too late. Protect your family by calling Tim at 232-9981. Budweiser's weekday sports beat continues after this on Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT.